Hello and welcome to the MB Om podcast, where you will learn to master the business of yoga with guests from around the world who have experienced becoming successful yoga teachers, studio owners, and much more. Now, here's your host, Amanda Kingsmith.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the MB Om podcast. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Fave Yogis. Here's a business tool that's really going to change the lives of yoga teachers. The Fave Yogis app puts control and freedom in your hands. You can update your class schedule, offer your own classes anywhere, anytime, and get paid all from your phone. No more updating your schedule in multiple places and paying a ton of money each month for a software platform where students might stumble across your classes. Students simply open Fave Yogis and your schedule will be there. On top of being able to send students notifications about class updates, set prices and ticket availability, and auto-send reminders to your students, you can also post workshops and events that will allow you to reach organic traffic through the search feature that you may never have been able to reach through simply putting the events on your website. There's also a brand new feature on the Fave Yogis app. If you're teaching a lot of classes, you can now auto-generate text for sharing your schedule on social media. Along with the time and date, you can optionally include the title and location of each class or event. So head on over to the App Store on your mobile phone and download Fave Yogis for free. It's FAVYOGIS, and you can use code MBOM and let them know that I sent you. And as always, I really appreciate the support that you give to our sponsors because they really, really, really help for me to be able to continue to produce the podcast in a super high quality. All right, now on to today's guest for the podcast. I am super, super, super excited to be joined by Trina Altman. Trina received her training through Stott Pilates as well as is an ERYT 500. She's the creator of Yoga Deconstructed and Pilates Deconstructed, which take an interdisciplinary approach to foster an embodied understanding of yoga and Pilates and the relationship to modern movement science. She has presented at Kripalu, the Yoga Alliance Leadership Conference, and Yoga Works, among others. She also created and taught a Pilates continuing education course for physical therapists and is part of the faculty for the Brain Longevity Conference at UCLA. She was also a finalist in the Next Pilates Anytime Instructor Competition in 2017. Her work has been published in both Yoga Journal and Yoga International. Her book, Yoga Deconstructed, Transitioning from Rehabilitation Back into the Yoga Studio, is slated to be published by Handspring Publishing in December 2019. She is joining us all the way from Los Angeles, and we have a really awesome conversation about Pilates, yoga, movement, business, the business of yoga, and I just find everything that Trina's doing to be so inspirational, and she just presents it in a way that is so humbling and grounding, and I really hope that you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. So without further ado, here is Trina. I am very excited to be joined on the podcast today by Trina Altman from Pilates Deconstructed and Yoga Deconstructed. Trina, welcome to the show today.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, me too. And where are you joining me from today?
I live in Los Angeles.
Amazing. And I'm sure you have great weather right now.
We do. And it's funny because sometimes we have May gray and June gloom, which is strange because it's all supposed to be really nice this time of year, but today is sunny. So
nice.
It's very exciting. Yeah.
Awesome. I'm so excited for our conversation today. And I really want to dive into, you know, the business you've created for yourself, the on and online brand that you have, but I wanted to back up and talk about how you first got into Pilates and yoga. Like, which came first? What's the story behind that?
Yeah. Let's see, it was 10 years ago that I took my 200-hour teacher training, and I'm 46, so, you know, I had a lot of careers from age, different careers from age 20 to, I guess, would have been like around 35, 36 before I came into this career. So I don't know if you want me to go there, but I can start from 10 years ago. Yeah, I had been practicing yoga for a while, I think like a lot of people, and was transitioning out of a career and trying to figure out what to do with my life because I didn't want to be in the corporate world anymore.
I get that.
I was done with sitting, you know, at desks you know, and doing what used to be the term FaceTime, right, where you have to get there before your boss and still be there, you know, after your boss leaves.
And always seen doing something productive.
Exactly. And there was no internet that back then to, like, you know, distract yourself in downtime. You know, we would try to, like, oh, should I pull out my paperback book? And you know, like, that would look really bad if you walked in. So at least, you know, nowadays, I think if you have a desk job, maybe you can kind of sneak some internet time when things are slow. But yeah, so long story short was my husband was like, you really love this yoga thing. Why don't you do a teacher training? And I had every reason why I shouldn't, you know, we don't have the money. You know, my first job out of college, I worked at Goldman Sachs on Wall Street. And then after that, I worked as fashion designer, jewelry designer, textile designer. And, you know, it was just like, I was like, I can't, like, my parents will freak out if I tell them I'm going to be a yoga teacher. You know, yeah. Like, why did they send me to college and all that? And he was, you know, kind of like, well, who are you living your life for? Like, if this is what makes you happy, you should do it. So I did my 200 hour and then we were moving. And so I wanted to do my 300 hour with the same teacher. So I started doing the 300 hour modules while I was in my 200 hour, but my 200 hour was 1 week in a month for 13 months. So that was really, wonderful. I like learning slowly. And then when I finished my 300 hour, we moved a lot. So I started the 200 hour in Connecticut. Then we moved to Milwaukee, and then after Milwaukee, Iowa, and then after Iowa, California. And then, of course, before Connecticut, I lived in a lot of other places. but I started my Pilates training because I was teaching at a studio in Iowa that had both yoga and Pilates. And the woman was going on maternity leave, and she said, there's a training. It's about 45 minutes away. You know, if you do the training and you pass your test, would you like to cover for me while I'm on maternity leave? And so I was like, sure, why not? So that's how I ended up doing Pilates, like starting that training. And I did my training through STOT. So it's in modules. Mm-hmm. So it's a comprehensive, but it's different in the sense that, like, I just did the reformer training because then I could teach reformer classes, and that was all that was being offered. And then after that, I did mat, and then I did Cadillac chair and barrel. So in both situations, when I lived in Connecticut, there was, like, the yoga training I did was the only one in, like, the tri-state area. And when I lived in Iowa, the only Pilates training in the area. So very different, I think, than how it is now, where you're like, which training should I take? Mm-hmm. Was like, this is the training, either take it or don't take it. And I was very happy with, I loved both my, you know, 200 and 300 hour teacher, as well as my Pilates teacher for that training. So that's, and then we moved to LA, and I went to India right before moving here, and I'm just a, like, a never-ending learner type of person. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine I knew about Yoga Tune-Up and Jill because when we lived in Connecticut, she would come out and do workshops. And I never took a workshop with her. I just never ended up, you know, working with my schedule. But when we would go visit California, my husband's family's from here, I had a friend who used to own that Connecticut studio, and we took a workshop with Jill, and then I guess I ended up on, she worked for Yoga Works, so I ended up on the newsletter for Yoga Works, and I got this, you know, email that was like, Yoga Tune-Up Level 1 training. This was back in 2010, and it was a 7-day training, and we had just moved here, and I'm like, I have to take this, and my husband was like, really? Because, like, you just did your 200, your 300, your Pilates training, and went to India. And I was like, I know, but I don't know. I just feel like, I think it was in my gut, I had started subbing a little bit. And it was really a blessing because I had kind of learned enough in my Pilates training about exercise science and kinesiology and just principles of overloading versus underloading and all of that, to realize when I moved here, and most people wanted like pretty hardcore flow classes, that when I was subbing for people and teaching these classes and sort of watching what was happening, I was like, ooh, I don't think I can do this. So maybe I shouldn't teach yoga, because this is what everyone wants here in LA. It was a little different in Milwaukee and Iowa. They were okay with like more Hatha style stuff. Mm-hmm. And so when I took the Yoga Tune-Up Level 1 training, I was like, oh, this is how I can still teach yoga. I just have to call it something different. And this then gives me permission when people show up to say like, hey, this isn't a vinyasa flow class. In this class, I'm going to teach you some corrective exercise and some strength and stability along with more traditional yoga. And so that's was sort of the beginning of, you know, kind of finding my niche, I guess you would say, in the yoga space.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much good stuff in there. Thank you so much for sharing all of that.
Okay. I always hesitate to how far to, you know, go down that rabbit hole.
No. I think it's like, you know, going back to the beginning of your story and making this big career change. So that was kind of me like in my mid-20s. And I know kind of the reactions that I got from people having only been in the corporate world for a couple of years and then being like, you know, you've got this degree, you graduated with honors, like you had this really great job, and now you're like, doing what? Sorry, like what are you doing?
Exactly.
And I can only imagine what that'd be like, you know, being 10 years older than that. So it's like you're a decade more into your career. It's like there's more expectations because now you're in your 30s. Like you should have your stuff figured out by the time you're in your 30s. I feel like it's like slightly more forgivable while you're in your 20s because people are like, okay, you're kind of still figuring your stuff out. How did you, like, what was the reactions from people when you're like, okay, I'm, you know, making this big change?
Well, you know, I had made a lot of changes, so I was never somebody who knew what they wanted to do career-wise. I mean, I grew up in Oklahoma in the 70s, and I remember, like, my mom never worked. Like, none of the moms worked. The only moms who worked were, like, the ones who were divorced, and then they're like, okay, I guess I'll get a job selling shoes at Saks Fifth Avenue or, like, sell real estate. So it wasn't even, like, I, it's crazy to say this now. I remember when the Equal Rights Amendment vote came out in the 70s, and one of my friend's mom had, like, the bumper sticker. And I came home, and I'm like, what's ERA, you know, and my mom told me, and I remember it didn't pass. And so, you know, when I got to college, it was just kind of like, okay, well, what classes do I like the most? And then I'll just do that for my major because I have to take a lot of classes in that subject. So I did political science because I figured, oh, well, maybe I'll go to DC and like work in, you know, government or something. I knew people that did that. So my whole entire so I switched careers out of that before I even graduated. I interned in the White House and I interned in the Senate and was like, okay, I don't want to do this. So then, you know, I ended up at the on Wall Street, and I was only there for like 5 months or 6 months. And then I started temping, which was like a brand new thing. And I temped in every industry. I mean, you name it, magazine publishing, advertising. I mean, some that I didn't want to do. Or remember, I ended up at this one place that was like, for one day, was like a phone sex call center.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And I didn't even realize it was in like a really nice part. I lived in New York City all through my 20s. And when I realized, because I was like the general receptionist, but like what was going on, I was like, I called my temp agency and was like, you need to send me to a new job location. So, I mean, I really like bounced around trying to figure it out. And so I'm going on a tangent. Let's see. What did people say? So, you know what? I guess I'd say by that time, I didn't really care because I had already like done. I worked at Barney's and went to FIT at night because I wanted to be a fashion designer. I did that for a while and then started creating my own jewelry and selling my own jewelry to Barney's and all these places all over the country. And then when I moved for this guy back to Oklahoma, there was no fashion designer jewelry design, but there was a textile design place. So at age 35, I had probably, I already had like four careers.
I love that.
I was like, whatever, now I just got to figure out what I really want to do, or try something different. So,
I think that's amazing. I mean, one of my big things from, I guess, the business side of yoga specifically is like when you're a new teacher, I think you need to say yes to a lot of things to find out what your no's are. And I mean, I think that applies to life in general. It's like, when you don't know what you want to do, which is a lot of us, like a lot more people, I think, don't know what they want to do than people who kind of like come out of the womb being like, I'm going to do this with my life and do it forever. Kind of need to like just say yes to things that you're interested in. And then you're like, nope, did that. That's in the no category. What's on? Like, what's next? What else am I interested in?
Exactly. It's like dating. I mean, there are a few people, I guess, that marry their sweetheart from high school. But most of us, you have to get out there and date a bunch of different kind of people to figure out what is going to work or not work. And it's the same thing, or at least for me, it was with jobs and career selection.
yeah, absolutely. I think that's great. And then so, fast forwarding to you're at this point where you've taken all these trainings and you're starting to teach. I'm curious what it was about being in those classes. Like, what did you see in people's practices or in people's bodies that kind of made you think to yourself, like, I need to be teaching something a little different?
Well, I think, the classes that were really popular at the time and I think are now still, I just don't live in that bubble anymore, were, flow classes to music. And I grew up, I was a gymnast and a cheerleader. And so when I first started practicing yoga regularly, my first introduction to it was in college, and it was Kripalu, and it was very sort of free flow, free form, a lot of like Dawn Stapleton style. But when I did Bikram in my 20s in New York, I was like, oh, this is awesome. Like, it's just like gymnastics, but I can actually do it. I don't have to do the back handsprings or the back flips. I can, and I feel relaxed afterwards. So I think what happened is I got out there and I was like, okay, these flow classes are pretty much like going from one end range of motion to another quickly without a lot of instruction, because there's either music like Krishna Das in the background and the teacher would just walk around, like inhale up, exhale fold, inhale halfway, exhale jump back, So I guess I knew enough as like a skilled mover in my childhood and teenage years to know that these people who are sitting at desks all day shouldn't be doing the gymnasticsy stuff that I was doing as a kid.
that makes sense. When you say it, it sounds like a little bit ridiculous.
And I'm hypermobile. So, I was doing like wheel pose just for fun and feeling no stretch in my body from probably the age of 5 on. But I knew that that wasn't normal. And so, seeing people do, just like going from up dog, to down dog or chaturanga, to like jumping back. I was like, wow, like this is pretty, not just athletic, but athletic in a acrobatic way. Mm-hmm. And that, kind of made me a little uncomfortable. As the teacher watching it happen in front of me going, wait, these people, would probably benefit from something that's slightly regressed than what they're doing right now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely challenging as a teacher, especially in, I think, bigger cities. At least this has been my experience, is that there's kind of this like, okay, I'm really busy. I have like 50 minutes or 1 hour in my day, and I want like an all encompassing thing. Like, right. I want to sweat. I want to feel like I've worked hard. I want to like feel like limber and feel like I've like stretched my body a little bit. And I also want relaxation. And as a teacher, you're like, okay, you're asking a lot. Like, it's like, how can I give you all of this and not hurt you?
Right, right. And I think it works for a while with a very specific population. You know, I think like people in their 20s who maybe tend towards being flexible or just are really athletic, you can get away with doing those kinds of classes for a while. You know, it depends from person to person. But I guess I didn't want to be sort of the, you know, the, I guess with the conveyor belt, sort of just like, you know, people come in, they do the thing with me, and then they get hurt and then they leave. And then I take the next group in, they come in, they do it for a while, they get a repetitive stress injury, and then they leave. So, yeah, it was a great solution for me, teaching yoga tune-up, because, number one, yoga studios back then didn't want it. Like, I couldn't get a job teaching a yoga tune-up class at a yoga studio. So what I did was, I had blocks, blankets, straps, and balls. And, I would drive to this Muay Thai boxing gym that was like an hour and 15 minutes away. They paid me $30 a class.
Oh my gosh.
But I loved it. And this, they loved it because I guess, you know, they were athletes and they appreciated, the very sort of logical, analytical approach of like, okay, well, like if we're going to do crow pose, like let's first see what kind of range of motion you have in wrist extension and like how much you can load that that's tolerable without pain. And like, then we'll start with, you know, like, okay, well, how strong are your adductors, your inner thighs? Because most of yoga is all just stretching your inner thighs. And for crow pose, you kind of need some inner thigh strength. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's going to all be load on your wrists and your shoulders. And they appreciated that because I guess, you know, a lot of them were training for competition and they understood just sort of basic like exercise science training protocols.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I mean, talking about like any types of movement things when it comes to yoga always makes me think like, why have we not figured more of this out? Like when you're thinking about stuff like, okay, you know, why can't right. I do this in my body? Okay, because I don't have that range of mobility or it's loading too much on something that's not designed to have that much load on it.
Well, because, you know, of the sort of lineage history, sort of non-scientific history of yoga. So like, you know, when Padapi Joyce says practice and all is coming, that kind of means like just keep doing crow until you can do crow. Mm-hmm. And I think if you've only been exposed to that and you haven't ever trained for something, I mean, I wasn't in, when I did gymnastics and cheerleading growing up, it was the same as yoga. Like my teacher would be like, okay, here's the trick, do the trick. You know, like, and then the prep for the trick was like, okay, try to do a black flip on this squishy, you know, mat that's like 10 inches thick. So when you fall on your head, you don't hurt yourself. Mm-hmm. And then once you can do it on the squishy mat without landing on your head, then you do it on the regular ground, you know, or like you would do it on the trampoline with like a belt around your waist suspended from the ceiling. And then it would be like, okay, you did it on the trampoline, like try it on the floor.
You know? Yeah. It's so interesting.
Things have changed. And I think the people, you know, I mean, obviously I'm younger, but yeah, there wasn't, exercise science wasn't even a field of study, at like colleges and universities, I don't think until at least what, the 70s or the 80s? I'm not sure, but I know when I graduated college in 94, and I mean, the school I went to didn't have a lot of career prep type things. Like, they didn't even have business. It was like you had to take economics. But I don't know that information was really out there, at least until probably the 80s when Arnold Schwarzenegger came on the scene with his weightlifting protocols.
People are like, what on earth is this?
Yeah, no. So we're kind of catching up, I think, on all of that just by trial and error.
Yeah, absolutely. That definitely makes sense. And so you started teaching, you know, sort of maybe like a more unique type of yoga in your classes. And then at what point did you actually create Pilates Deconstructed and Yoga Deconstructed?
Well, when I taught Pilates, I'm really curious and I love to explore. And I thought, well, you know, why can't I apply these same principles of regressions to Pilates? So there's, you know, in general, there's like classical Pilates and contemporary Pilates. And classical is kind of like, say, having a lineage. You have a lineage. So either my teacher studied directly with Joseph, or I studied directly with Joseph, which isn't really the case anymore because the people who did are, you know, there's only a couple left still alive. And so we teach, you know, what he taught exactly as he taught it, or exactly as we think we know how he taught it. And contemporary is more, well, no, we teach to the body in front of us. We've learned a lot of stuff since then. And so I was trained in contemporary Pilates, but it was still more just like a modification of the classical. So, you know, like these are the exercises, these are the order. And I was like, well, you know, I'm teaching these mixed level reformer classes. And, you know, there's an exercise that's really, you know, not advanced, but say intermediate. Why am I teaching, you know, just these sort of random things to warm up when I could actually make it super specific and have people like ask questions of themselves along the way, like, oh, okay, we're working towards this kind of challenging side bending exercise. You know, how does it feel when we do a side bend with a lot more support and more help from gravity versus later in class when we do it with a lot less support and no help from gravity?
Mm-hmm.
So I was, there's a company called Fusion, EDU, Fusion Education, and they're based out of Asheville, North Carolina, and they do just like super nerdy continuing ed online Pilates courses. And they reached out to me and asked me if I would create a course for them. And I was like, sure. I had no idea what I was going to do. and it took me a good 2 to 3 years to come up with the material and, you know, have it ready to film.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, because of how I was teaching in my classes, I'm like, oh, I might as well call this Pilates Deconstructed because I'm deconstructing an exercise or a skill set.
Okay. Yeah. That's really cool. Was that your first online course that you created?
Yes. Yeah. It's, there's three of them. And, basically like I deconstruct different Pilates exercises in all three. And there's like an anatomy sort of portion at the end. So it's like an embodied class. And then afterwards, like modifications and why did we do this? And let's look at this on the skeleton to understand this joint movement kind of thing.
Yeah, that's really cool. And what was that experience like creating that online course? Because I know that the first time we do anything, it's so hard.
It was so hard. You know, it's funny. I started by recording myself teaching my regular classes and then coming home and listening to the recordings and taking notes on what I had taught and then kind of modifying the classes by seeing what worked and what didn't work over the course of about a year. And then from there, I was like, okay, I have these handwritten notes of these classes, but now I need to type it up and also have notes in there just to trigger my mind of, you know, what I want to remember while I'm teaching. So like the sort of the why are we doing this? You know, how is it affecting the body? So then I kind of got on the computer and started with that. And then they asked me, they were great. Like it was a wonderful learning experience because they're super organized. So they had like a 5-page form that I had to fill out that was like, what's the description of your course? You know, what populations is this course appropriate for? What are, you know, all the bullet points of things that people will learn in this course? You know, if you were going to teach this course live, can you create create a live description for this course? So, you know, I had homework all along the way that kind of got me there. And then I was at that point teaching trainings for yoga tune-up live and was used to, you know, prepping for in-person trainings, teaching trainings and immersions and stuff. So I use those big white sticky notepads when I teach live. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to use those when I film. So I wrote out, you know, basically like my whole class sequence, but then in different colors, I'd put like this exercise relates to, I have, you know, like different, I guess you would say like bullet point things that I wanted to hit conceptually for, you know, what makes it a Pilates deconstructed class. And so the cool thing was we didn't shoot it straight through. I'd have like a sticky pad thing and I'd look at my notes and I'd teach like the first three exercises and, you know, all the stuff I wanted to say. And then I'd say cut. And then we'd flip the chart and I'd look at the notes. So yeah, it was, I broke it down into manageable bite-sized chunks that way.
Okay. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I think you kind of have to do that just because it's like, I don't know. Yeah. It's so different when you're online versus doing something in person.
Yeah. And, you know, these courses are all like CECs for the Pilates Method Alliance. So I also had to like fill out a form for Pilates Method Alliance, like a big giant packet of, you know, to get it approved. Whereas like if I'm just, you know, even though when I taught my first online classes, I prepped in a big way. It wasn't, when I showed up, it was more just like, okay, just teach like I teach a regular class. I just have these notes that I'm sticking to. Mm-hmm. Whereas when it's continuing education credits, it was, and I knew I had to create a quiz. It was a lot more detailed and required a lot more time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so since then, you've created a number of online classes and programs. What has that been like since like creating that very first one?
Well, the first one was fabulous because I was never an actor or an actress. I mean, I was in one school play where I played like a snail with no lines.
That's amazing.
And even in college, I made myself teach a public speaking course, because I was afraid of it and I hated every minute of it. So, actually, when I did my 200 hour, I said I would only teach privates because I was too afraid to get up in front of a group and teach. So I had to do a lot of coaching around that and sort of psychotherapy around that. And so that was a big hurdle for me to climb was, you know, like just having the courage to go to an audition at a gym or a studio to teach a group class. Mm-hmm. But it was the same exact problem with the video. So I had a student of mine who was a filmmaker, and this was when YouTube just kind of started and social media wasn't like a huge thing. Facebook was kind of mostly like you would just share pictures and articles and stuff.
Like back when everyone's profile was open.
Oh, you mean like public?
Yeah, like everyone's stuff was public and people wrote on your wall to communicate things. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. And I was like, no way, I don't want to film myself. You know, I knew I needed to film little videos because I was teaching workshops and I was promoting them on Facebook. And he's like, no, it'll be fine. Like And because I knew him and he was a friend, and he had more confidence in me than I had in myself, I got over the fear of it all. But I think that's really important because even the first time I did a photo shoot, it was a disaster. Like I looked constipated the entire time in every picture because I didn't really have a rapport with the photographer or feel comfortable. And so I think it's the same for filming because it was so hard for me. I'm like, how am I teaching to a machine? I teach to people. Mm-hmm. And so I got over that hump with him. And then, you know, I had it again with filming for Fusion Pilates. And every time it was like a new hump to get over. So I think having a support network of people around you who, you know, can tell you it's going to be okay. It's not, it's really not that bad. You know, like if you hate it, you can always erase it and start over. is really important.
I think that is really important. And I think that it is knowing that, you know, maybe it's not going live, like you can edit it, everything's going to be okay with that. And even if you don't end up needing to edit anything, I think it's just nice to know in the back of your head, like, okay, at any point I can like stop and get up to go to the bathroom and we can cut it out. It's not a big deal.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, there was this transition where everybody, you know, I came up in yoga where there was like four or five DVDs. There was like the Chivare DVD, the Sean Korn DVD, you know, of course, Rodney Yee, who had all of his Guyam DVDs. And then like other people started to come out with DVDs, but there was still only like a handful of the like Yoga Journal sort of touring famous yoga teachers. And so when everyone started filming for social media and YouTube, I was like, there's no way. Like, it needs to be the quality of like a Chivare DVD that's filmed, you know, at the beach and then, you know, along the equator with like Hollywood style editing. And the more people just started shooting things that were just like phone quality, because when, you know, before it was easy to shoot on your phone, you still had to get like a video camera and figure it out. I think it was more intimidating. And then people just started posting whatever, like the lighting wasn't good, who cares? The, you know, the sound wasn't that great, who cares? Like people just were hungry for the information and to get to know you as a teacher, you know, but beyond like reading your bio and seeing a flyer.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That must have been like an interesting time to be a part of the yoga world, because it's like you're used to sort of one way of doing things, which is all in person. And then all of a sudden it's like,
yep,
the whole world is online.
Yeah, exactly. It was. And then, you know, a lot of times if you teach, back then everything was very sort of style based. I mean, it still is, but, you know, there was, it was like, oh, well, you know, this is a Anyasara technique and, you know, you're not allowed to teach it unless you like, you know, teach an Anyasara class and tell everyone you learned this thing from John Friend. So there was a lot of that live, but then when it came online, it existed too as sort of, I mean, you know, with Bikram, for example, like I think, you know, say you were a Bikram teacher and you wanted to teach some online stuff. I mean, God forbid, right? You might like lose your Bikram license because supposedly that was owned by Bikram. So once he lost his lawsuit and it was determined that no one owns human movement anymore, I know for me and many of us that freed up this feeling of like, yeah, like no one invented, you know, like bending your knee and externally rotating your hip with, you know, and bringing yourself into this shape or that shape, like our bodies do all kinds of things. And, and yeah, it's, you can make a video of whatever you want. It's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so interesting. I didn't even think about that. Cause I feel like I'm like, you know, so far separated from that in terms of when I started teaching. Yeah, that would be like a complicated sort of like, it's like a big transition. Everyone's trying to figure out like, what are the rules? Who can do what? Yeah. Who cannot do what? What was it like for you, like going from, you know, teaching these classes in person, these workshops in person, which of course I know you still do, but to having like really taking your brand online and really having a lot of online offerings and having people discover you like all over the world?
Yeah, it was a slow, steady process. So I think I started on Facebook in like 2008 or 9. And yeah, it was just completely friend oriented, like, wow, I can keep in touch with all these people that I haven't seen since high school or college or since that, you know, job I had when I was 22 and now I'm 38. And it kind of morphed over time. So every time I would teach a workshop, I would end up friending those people on Facebook. Or every time I would go to somebody else's workshop, I'd meet people. And so the networking became online as well as in person. And that started to grow my, you know, my audience or following or whatever you want to call it, you know, your community, from just where you live or where you've lived in the past to all over the place. Every time you go somewhere and meet somebody, like you can interact with them daily on the internet. so I used Facebook a lot, and would always, then when I taught something, like take a group photo at the end and tag everyone in it so that then they would be able to connect with each other. I'm a huge reader, so I would share all of the like podcasts or videos or blogs that I was reading and write something about why I thought it was important or interesting. And that built my following a lot. And it was easy because I love reading anyway. So it was like no extra work for me to just be like, this article is awesome. Like, here's why you should read it. And then I would meet people who had written those articles, quote unquote, online. And then once Instagram started, you know, I was like, what's the point? Like, I'm supposed to take pictures of my food or what? Like, what is this about? This is so boring. And then I, you know, Instagram really morphed because it used to be, I think, 10-second videos. And I was, you know, and then they moved it up to 1-minute videos. And so once it was, or maybe it was 30 seconds, something like that.
And even videos came a little bit like a couple of years into Instagram, didn't it?
Yes, definitely. And then my hurdle was I finally did like photo shoot and I was posting images of things that I would teach in class and then talk about them, you know, in the caption. But the video thing, I tried a video camera. I couldn't get it to work. I mean, you know, I'm not a millennial. And then even when it was easy to do it on my phone, I still, it was like the tripod and the sound. So a friend of mine decided she was going to do like a video series for her brand and asked me if I would be in them. And I was like, sure. And so it was great because, you know, we're around the same age. And I was like, oh, okay. So I could just buy the same tripod you have. This isn't, I can handle that, you know. And she had like a little microphone and like it worked. So I was like, okay, I've never found one that works, but this one is working. I'm going to try it. But I must say, I then did all of that. And I still hire somebody most of the time to shoot anything that's more than, you know, just like a little thing on my phone. I'm good at certain things, but if I have to film something that's longer than say 10 minutes, I hire somebody else to do it.
Yeah.
It's just not worth my time. It's not, one of my,
major strengths.
Major strengths. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
exactly.
I think that's a good like business lesson. Like you know, you are good at doing the teaching. And if your teaching becomes less good because you're trying to fiddle around with the technology and maybe you're feeling like flustered and frustrated, it's like that doesn't benefit anyone.
No, it definitely doesn't. And, you know, now there are so many people that, I mean, I live in LA, so of course it's easy to hire somebody who, you know, like works as a, you know, filmmaker for movies and stuff. But, you know, if I didn't, I would just hire a millennial, you know, to use their phone.
Oh, that's funny. Even then, though, I think I fit into like millennial category and still, like, I remember creating my first online course on Udemy and just it was so frustrating. Like, yeah. So many growing pains with that. And I'm so glad that I did it and that I saw it through and whatnot, because I feel like we need to push ourselves to actually learn. But
yeah,
there were a lot of moments where I was like, maybe somebody should just be doing this for me, because I don't know if this is my strength.
Well, exactly. And, you know, when I was younger, I mean, you know, my husband and I, we don't have kids, and it's like I can afford to do that. But when I had my first business, when I made jewelry and sold it to stores all over the country, you know, the first iMac came out. I remember there was like red, blue, or I forgot what the other, red, blue, or green. It was like this gigantic box, but it was the coolest thing ever. And, you know, I asked for it for my birthday, and I remember it was like $1,200, which was like astronomically priced back in 97. And I just figured it out, like how to create my own brochures and all of that, because I didn't have money to pay somebody. So, you make it work one way or another, because otherwise that obstacle is going to prevent you from selling what you need to sell.
Yeah, absolutely. That definitely makes sense. And then I'm curious, throughout your career, what are some of the biggest business lessons that you've learned? I know we've touched on quite a few of them already, but, you know, what are some of the other like big things you've learned as a yoga teacher, Pilates teacher, online course creator, workshop runner, all the different things that you do?
I think number one is find the thing that you're passionate about. You don't have to know everything. No one can ever know everything. But just find what you're passionate about and learn everything about that. And for us, since, you know, yoga involves movement, I think it's important to have a movement experience of what you're offering. So, and I'd say the biggest lesson, the way, you know, I sold clothes at Barney's on commission in my 20s, and but I was really good at it because I loved shopping for clothes. Mm-hmm. And so as a somebody who was, you know, selling clothes to people, it was like I just behaved in the way that I wanted somebody to behave if I were needing help finding clothes mm-hmm. to buy. And I find, and so I, that's what I've always done. Like I've always taken private lessons in yoga and Pilates, and I teach private lessons. So, it, you know, I just think, okay, well, how did my teacher, when I'm in the private, behave when I was doing an exercise where it was so hard, I looked like I probably wanted to cry. Like, how did she support me? And that's how I'm going to support my student. Or how did the teacher respond when I got really sick with the flu and had to cancel? Like, did she give me one freebie or did she charge me for missing it the very first time? And I think it's really important to be a consumer or a customer of the service that you're offering.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I think that that is so important. Like you really need to understand what it's like to go through that buying process in order to set mm-hmm. that up as the person who's selling.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, if I gave the example of privates, but same thing for group classes or workshops or teacher trainings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think too, like retreats as well. Like I think it's really hard to imagine yourself in the seat as a teacher leading a retreat if you've never been on a retreat and you've never really seen what that flow is like and what you liked mm-hmm. and didn't like about that experience as the person who's like on vacation for a week.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, yeah. I really love that.
Well, and I was going to say, I think the other major thing is being okay with, you know, I might have really liked it when I took private lessons and my teacher did XYZ, but somebody else might not like that at all. And so when I behave in a way with my clients that I think is best because that's what I like, not being surprised if my client doesn't like it because they're not me.
Mm-hmm.
And going, oh, okay, well, I thought that would work because that's what I liked, but let's like regroup and start over. I'm going to try this and see if this works better because not everyone is like me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's an important lesson for all aspects of yoga. Like I remember the first time I ever taught a private, my like outer hips are really, really tight. So it's like, that's something I do in all of my personal practices. And I'm working with mm-hmm. this girl one-on-one. And we're doing a couple of exercises for the outer hips. And she's like, yeah, I just like don't really feel anything. And I was like, wait, what? And she's like, I'm like, sorry, like, can you try this? And she's like, yeah, easy. Like literally yeah. like no tension in her outer hips. And she doesn't exercise. She doesn't do yoga. And I was like, this feels like a little bit unfair. Like what the hell?
Yeah.
But it was this reminder that, you know, not everybody's body is the same as mine. So it's like something that I'm like, I really want to dive deep into this because it's really like impactful in my physical body. Doesn't mean that that's what somebody else mm-hmm. needs in theirs.
Yeah. And you can't really learn that so much from a group class because there's no dialogue. Like you might see somebody in the class doing the outer hip stretch, but you don't know that they're not feeling anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you might see that they have more range of motion, but you don't know that they're not feeling any stretch. Whereas in a private, just like you described, you can say like, really, you're not, not even if you do this. And they're like, no. And you know, her background too. It's not like, oh, well, she's been stretching her outer hips for the last 10 years. So that's why.
Yeah.
Like she's never stretched her outer hips. And, so I do think, teaching privates and taking privates is really important. You know, as far as becoming a better teacher.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I really like that. And then it seems like you've done a lot of, you know, self-learning and also learning in classes and that sort of thing. What do you feel like, or do you have any like key resources for people to kind of learn more about maybe like biomechanics, mobility, these ranges of motion, like things that are kind of mm-hmm. maybe a little bit outside of the box from your average like teacher training program?
Yeah. For me, and what I would recommend is, I think first you have to know your own body. If you take private sessions with a personal trainer or another yoga instructor who maybe specializes in, you know, mobility and biomechanics, or you take private Pilates or gyrotonic sessions, or you just go to a physical therapist. And a lot of PT physical therapists are also yoga teachers, or they're also Pilates trained, and take individual lessons from them. You'll start to understand what's going on in your own body, because I don't think you can, I mean, maybe you can, but I think it's best to approach all of this from at least first understanding your own body, mm-hmm. Knowing what works and what doesn't work for you. And then, like, that's step one. And I like to learn in a one-on-one setting because of that dialogue. Like, you know, I've taken a ton of trainings, but in a training, you know, you can't be like during the Q&A. So, you know, I have this hip thing and I want to know blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, that's something you ask your physical therapist, because, you know, I really highly recommend learning in a one-on-one environment about all of these topics for yourself first. Like, what does it feel like? Like, if you might not ever, yoga teachers who've never done weightlifting, how can you understand teaching others about load if you haven't experienced load personally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I think that would be step one. And then step two is, of course, the, you know, just wherever you're passionate about. So, like, if you like to learn on Instagram or Facebook, or you like to take 2-hour workshops from, you know, teachers who are teaching them on the weekends, or, you know, there's a training you really want to dive into, or you just, one of the biggest, most helpful things I think I've done to learn over all these years is to take as many different types of movement classes as possible. I just everything from, you know, I take Feldenkrais and, you know, obviously Pilates and yoga, but just dance classes. I take jumping trampoline classes, just all of it, so that you understand the human body as a human body, not like as a body that poses, or a body that tap dances, or a body that performs, you know, martial art kicks. Like, the body's the body, and then everything else is just a methodology.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think those are two really important things. I love the idea of learning one-on-one, and then also making sure that you're really, like, you understand that thing within yourself before actually going out to teach it. I mean, it makes me just think about when you're teaching classes in general, like, it's really hard to teach a pose that you've never practiced before. Like, how are you supposed to cue that and help other people get into it if you're, like, still figuring it out in your body?
Yeah. And also, you know, if you practice the pose, but you've never seen, like, a video of yourself doing the pose, or you've never, like, been in front of a mirror, say when you're doing even bird dog or cat cow, you only understand it from a sensorial perspective. You don't understand it visually. So, you know, what your students are seeing, say if you do a demo.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you take a private, like, say you're doing cat cow and the teacher is like, oh, this is great. Like, you're doing your, you know, cat, but you're only rounding in this one area of your spine. And then he or she taps you in the part where you're not rounding, and you're able to get some flexion there. You would never, ever know that if you didn't take a private or have somebody video you, or, like, kind of look in the mirror while you're doing it. And so that becomes a body blind spot. And it sort of doesn't, which means how are you might see it in your students, but I don't know. It's like telling your students to do something that you can't do, in my mind, sometimes can be I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying don't ever teach something you can't do, but I know that I'm a visual learner. I mean, I learn in all ways, but I'm very visual because I'm just always been an artist. And so sometimes it doesn't matter what somebody says or where they touch on my body. I need a visual of what they're asking. Mm-hmm. So just to keep that in mind, that like if you have students who are visual learners, maybe you want to know what the thing looks like that you're demoing, and make sure that, you know, that that's actually what you're asking them to do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that was like one of my biggest learnings, or one of the best things that came out of creating my first online course, was like videoing myself and then being like, huh, is that what I look like doing that? And it wasn't necessarily like, oh, I need to change this pose. Like for some cases it was like, okay, you know, maybe the alignment's not quite right there and I could definitely like, you know, strengthen this up or engage here. But it was just very interesting to be like, okay, you know, I imagine it this way in my head, and it's interesting to watch myself actually do that pose or to move through that series of poses.
Yeah. And to, it helps you normalize our differences. So every time I demo something, I'll say, you know, okay, I'm going to show you what I'm talking about, but like, A, know that I have weird, extremely hypermobile elbows. And so you don't need to make your elbows be weird and hypermobile like mine, you know, or yeah. B, like, you know, I have a long torso, so back bends are super easy for me. If you have a short torso, don't get upset. Just blame your mom and dad for not giving you a long torso. Like, you know, who cares? And being very clear with like how important anthropometrics are and how important like your genetics of, you know, what your, you know, soft tissues, like what's your collagen versus my collagen. And it like all of that is a factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And there's no one like correct way.
Yes, for sure. I love the idea of like pointing out that, you know, your body is different from mine. So this is going to like, it's not only going to look different, it's also going to feel different. And it's going to maybe be, you know, harder, easier. The sensation might be different. And it's like acknowledging that, you know, our bodies are all different because they are.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, even when, you know, being honest about like, I'm going to teach things that I enjoy and I'm good at. I'm going to teach the things that are challenging as well, but I'm not going to teach the stuff that I'm not good at. So like I am not good at like doing a ton of arm balances. And so if you want to learn arm balances, I'm not your girl. Mm-hmm. and like being okay with that. But like these are the things I really love teaching, and I can break them down and give you like a manageable step-by-step way to work towards it. And so this is within my wheelhouse and not feeling like you have to be everything to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I love that. So I have one more question for you.
Yeah.
I'm curious. We were talking about at the beginning how, you know, you never really knew what you wanted to do and you went through a bunch of different careers. Do you feel like you've kind of found the thing you want to do forever? Or is it kind of like you love this now and at some point it might shift?
No, I think this is it. You know, I mean, gosh, who knows, maybe in 10 years, you know, but no, I really do. You know, I can see myself doing this for the rest of my life. You know, finding a career that, you know, the two obstacles for me was every job I ever had, once I learned the job, I hated it and was bored. Mm-hmm. And when you're a teacher, an educator, the learning never ends. You're not stuck with like, oh, well, if I learn too much, then my boss is going to freak out and try to think I'm going to like steal his or her job from them. You can just keep learning and keep teaching the things that you're learning. And then the other obstacle for me was I'm a mover, and so many of my jobs involved, you know, not moving. And so, you know, having a job where I get to move a lot, it means that I can stick with this career for the rest of my life. So those were the two, you know, obstacles that took me like 15 years to figure out.
Nice. Yeah. Cool. I love that. That's awesome to hear. I was like, hopefully, you know, whatever answer is fine, of course. And I was like, hopefully this isn't like a contentious topic where you're like, I don't know. We'll see.
No, yeah, no. I mean, well, you know, the biggest factor was my husband really changed my paradigm around the way I was brought up. Was like, you know, you pick a career or a job that has really good health insurance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as your parents gives us a return on our investment, like we paid for your college. So like you need to get a job that's going to make money to pay back the college or whatever. And he, you know, was a doctor and like went into enormous amounts of debt to do what he wanted to do. And was like, well, you know, how your parents raised you is one way, but there's also this other way of like doing the thing you love to do, maybe going into debt for a little while. But then like having a happy life and being able to pay it off because you eventually like what you're doing, and making money doesn't feel like a job. It feels like your passion.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I really love that mindset. And I mean, I'm just like not a big fan, no matter how long you've been in a certain career. I feel like if it's not serving you anymore, it's, you need to listen to that and you need to go do something else, regardless of like, oh, you know, there's no like 401k contributions anymore, or my healthcare package isn't as good anymore. It's like, I feel like happiness is like above all of that.
Yes, me too. And, you know, I think there are some people who are, you know, you're obviously an entrepreneur at heart, and so am I, and we're okay with that kind of risk, but there are other people who aren't, and that's okay too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you're okay with a risk, I mean, for me, I'd much rather take a risk and be happy than not take a risk and be miserable.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree. And yeah, I love that you pointed out that, you know, everyone's different, as is all of our bodies are different. We're also different,
right,
you know, mentally and spirit as well. So tuning into what's right for you, because the path that you've taken, the path that I've taken might not be right for everyone out there who's listening, and just everyone in the world in general.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. I love that. So I really love this conversation. It's been so awesome. So thank you so much for your time today, Trina.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it too. Thank you so much for having me. I love listening to your podcasts. There's so much that I learn from listening to them. And it's really important, I think, to have, you know, business discussions around what we do as yoga teachers, because most of us are, you know, freelancers and entrepreneurs. So we have to spend a good amount of our time, whether we like it or not, doing those things so that we can do what we love. So it's nice to have help and support and resources.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for that. And so if people want to go find out more about you, maybe take a workshop or a training or an online course with you, where can they go to find that?
My website is my name, so trinaaltman.com, T-R-I-N-A-A-L-T-M-A-N. And I have everything there, all my live events, all my online courses, links to my social media, so Facebook and Instagram and my YouTube channel. And yeah, I'm easy to reach out to. You can, you know, fill out the contact form on my website, or you know, message me on Facebook or Instagram. The Instagram thing, I'm pretty good about. Sometimes I wish that it would just show you all your messages.
I know.
Right? Because occasionally I miss some, whereas on Facebook, I never miss any. Like every single person that has reached out to me there, it doesn't get like blocked or anything. Like it comes right on through. So
yeah, I think Instagram should shift that, because Facebook used to do that. Do you remember the days of Facebook where you'd go to the like filtered messages and you'd have like 12 messages from people you're not friends with, and you'd be like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm responding 2 years later.
I know. Yeah. So yeah, hopefully since Facebook owns Instagram, that it will change that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, amazing. And I'll put links to all of that in the show notes so that people can go and find that super easily.
Great. Thank you so much, Amanda.
Thank you. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode of the podcast with Trina Altman. Make sure you go check out what she's up to, check out her online courses, see if she's teaching a workshop near you. She is so, so awesome, and I'm so grateful to have had her on the show. As always, you can find everything over on the website at www.mbomyoga.com. You can find the podcast on Facebook and Instagram at Mastering the Business of Yoga, and you can join the private Facebook community at Yoga Business Badasses. Just search it in the search bar of Facebook. Facebook and answer the questions, and I'll let you on in. And it's a super supportive community where we talk about all things yoga and yoga business. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week. Namaste.